to Human Rights 2020s, a podcast from the Human Rights Consortium Scotland. This episode is a recording from an event called Our International Human Rights, Rights to Housing, held on the 5th of June 2024. In this episode, Consortium Director Barry Snowden introduces Professor Katie Boyle from the University of Strathclyde to discuss the right to housing and the impact this right could have when it is incorporated into Scots law. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to this webinar today, which is around our international human rights and looking specifically at the right to housing. So welcome, thank you for taking the time out to be here, and we are absolutely delighted to welcome back, because this is a series of webinars, welcome back Professor Katie Boyle, who is from the University of Strathclyde. We're absolutely really delighted to have you, and I know that you're such an expert around economic and social rights, so it's fab to be able to ask you lots of questions. Thank you. So what we're going to do is we're going to kick off with sort of 20, 25 minutes of just setting out what is this right to housing that we're talking about, some of what that means, what it looks like, and then, as I say, we'll absolutely come to questions. So first of all, on the face of it, the right to housing seems relatively a kind of straightforward idea that we should all have this right to housing. But it is actually comes from international human rights law and in the UN or international treaties and covenants. So this right to housing is in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It's in what is called the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, which is a bit of a mouthful, but often known as ICESCR. It's also in the Children's Rights Convention, it's in the Women's Rights Convention, it's in the Disabled People's Rights Convention, and multiple other places. So it's not just held in one place, but actually right to housing is recognised as really important across the international human rights system, and importantly the UK has signed up to these treaties. So if the UK has signed up to these, what does that mean, Katie, like for all of us, for this right? Does it mean that they have to comply? Is that scrutinised because it's at that kind of international level?
Thanks, Barry, and thanks very much again for the invitation to join you all. So yeah, that was a really helpful overview at the start, because the right to adequate housing is recognised as sort of fundamental to enjoyment of other rights, and is therefore repeated across a number of important international treaties. And as you said, the UK signed up to them. So that means that the UK, having signed and ratified those treaties, is under obligations in international law to comply with them. So that means it's the UK as a state is under an obligation, a legal obligation, to comply with the right to adequate housing at the moment, and has been under that obligation since the treaty was ratified in the 70s. However, the way that our legal system works in the UK, and this isn't a universal situation, other countries have other ways that their legal system is set up, but we're in the UK is what's called a dual estate. So that means that you go through a two-tier process. The first is to sign and ratify the treaty, and then for it to be applicable in domestic law, you need to go through a second process of incorporation, so incorporate it into domestic law, which is what a lot of the discussions we have in Scotland right now is, because essentially what the Scottish Government has promised to do is incorporate those international obligations that the UK hasn't yet done so into domestic law, to do that in devolved areas. And that's really important, because unless you incorporate, you have what's called an accountability gap, where it's very difficult to enforce your rights that are form part of the state's legal obligations at a domestic level. That was actually it was the same situation in relation to the European Convention of Human Rights. The UK had signed up to it before the Human Rights Act. You could still take cases to Strasbourg before that came in. And then in 1998, you had the Human Rights Act and the Scotland Act as well, which embedded ECHR and incorporated those rights domestically. So that's the gap that's seeking to be closed. In relation to that, and the right to adequate housing is like other rights under the International Covenant of Economic, Social and Cultural Rights. So Article 11 is where you find this right called the right to an adequate standard of living, and that includes housing as well as things like food, energy, water, like things for your being able to live, your right to life essentially, which is sometimes falls under civil and political rights treaties. But because those rights are indivisible, what ICESCR does is recognise that these building blocks are required, including housing or suitable shelter, adequate accommodation, whatever you want to call it. And you can break that down into what the International Human Rights gives us is a very clear decision-making framework. And so what's absent from decision making at the moment is there is no requirement to take these standards into account when making decisions around housing policies, housing provision, and also people's everyday experience of it, including habitability and rules against no forced evictions and ensuring due process is followed. And that's statewide. So if it's helpful, I could probably break down some of those different kind of components.
Absolutely. I think that's really helpful to be aware that actually the UK does have an obligation to meet all of those rights to the basic essentials, which includes the right to adequate housing at the moment. But because of our system, it's not then part of UK law, which is, as you were saying, about that accountability gap. But yeah, let's break it down a bit further. I'm just going to put some features into the chat box as well, because at the UN level, they don't just stick at you have the right to adequate housing, but there are what are called general comments, which is a very UN sort of term, I always think, but basically explainers, which go into a little bit more depth around, well, what are some of the details of that? Because in some ways, that's when rights really have sort of teeth, when we get into some of the details. So yeah, it'd be brilliant. I've put them in the chat box if you could tell us a little bit more about what the UN say about those different elements almost of that right to adequate housing.
Yeah, that's actually a really good question as well, because sometimes what people will say is like an actual treaty provision is very short, the same way it can often be in just any other kind of the piece of legislation. So you need to delve and dive a bit deeper to understand what it means when you break it down. And I was speaking at an event on Monday, which was to specifically to lawyers, and one of the questions that was asked was, well, how do we find out what these rights mean in practice? And so it's really important to raise that point that you say that we have what's called general comments. So general comments just come out of like commit, so there's a committee responsible for overseeing compliance with the covenants at international level. You get one committee per treaty. So the Committee on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights is a group of experts which are drawn from party states across the world, and they go in like 4-year cycles, and every so often they issue general comments to help explain further. So there's a general comments 4 and 7 on the right to adequate housing. And then you also have special procedures in the UN where you can have the appointment of an expert in an area. So there's been historically a UN special rapporteur on adequate housing who's actually, various guises of that role have visited the UK to examine whether or not we're in compliance. And then the committee also looks at it as well. So the way that the UN special rapporteur and the general comments work is to give us much, much more depth on what we actually mean by adequate housing and the right to housing. But also it's important to note that, as I mentioned earlier, states all over the world already embed this right into their domestic systems. So we also have like really rich jurisprudence, which is, you know, court adjudication on it that helps explain it a little bit more, as well as examples and practice through different legislators and policies around the world. And so there's a big body of really rich research and evidence that can help ensure that we properly understand the meaning and content of rights. But an important aspect that's often missing is the participation of the people involved as well. And so actually people who live in housing which doesn't meet this right are probably the greatest experts on what's required. And so ultimately, and to enforce a right properly, you need to have participative processes that hear from those people directly, and that's a really important component of it. So the way that those different sources break it down is to look at availability of housing. So that by that, it's not just the number and quantity and quality of housing, but actually when you create housing stock, do you ensure that you have availability of resources? So is there access to water, energy, storage, refuse, you know, your social services? The second component is around adequacy. So looking at cultural adequacy, for example, is a really, I'll give a, by way of example, sometimes you'll find that people are put in temporary accommodation and that can drastically impact on their cultural rights to cook and provide meals for their families in ways which meet their cultural heritage, for example, by not having any cooking facilities. And that's a breach of the right to adequate housing, to not accommodate that cultural norm, or, you know, standard of adequacy. Habitability, people will, you know, intrinsically know what that means around making sure that it's not cold, damp, there's appropriate heating, it's protected from rain, from water ingress, and that it's safe to live in, you know, that it's not, that there's not hazards. And again, we see there's a recent report within the last year about the danger temporary housing has become endemic, actually. Records of 50 up to 55 deaths of children. This was in England specifically, this report related to hazards that were posed as part of temporary accommodation, and that's a breach to the right to adequate housing. And then you've got affordability as a component. So affordability can be about the cost of housing, but it can also be about whether or not you're in rented housing or not, whether or not the cost of living there accommodates the income that you have. So proportionate to your overall income is how affordability can be measured. And that when, for example, rents get out of control, that there should be regulation of that to bring it back down, to make it manageable as part of a cost of living package for you to live in the house, in your area, in a way that is proportionate to your income. As well as just ensuring that, you know, in relation to overall household finances. So the cost of living crisis is a perfect example of a culmination and cluster of issues which directly impact on the right to adequate housing as well as a number of other rights.
Just check on that. So in terms of to pick up that affordability one, because I think that's really interesting. So what you're saying is not just about the kind of cost of your rent or your mortgage, whatever, overall. It's about how, like, almost the proportion that you have to spend on housing that might impact your other basic essentials that you need. Is that, have I understood that right? It's almost the interaction between the affordability of your housing with other things that is so relevant in the situation in the UK at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. And the way that economic, social, and cultural rights, as together with civil and political and environmental rights, operates is to recognise that you have to look at them holistically. One is entirely dependent on the other. So, for example, if your housing is not up to standard, it will most likely impact you in other areas of life. If it's too expensive, then you might end up getting into debt or rent arrears. If it's a, you know, not habitable in various different ways, if you've got damp or problems with heating or the cost of heating, then that's going to impact, for example, your health and the health perhaps of children living in the home, which can then impact their access to education, can impact you if you're feeling unwell in relation to employment issues. They're all so closely connected that they need to be looked at as a whole. And that's what that international framework does. That's what it allows you to do. It allows the indivisibility, the connectedness of each of those rights to be understood as a whole.
That is really helpful, actually, because I think it absolutely makes sense, but it also makes for a stronger protection for people, actually, if we look at them all together. In terms of accessibility, then, what do we understand about the right to adequate housing and accessibility?
Yeah, so accessibility is making sure that your housing provision accommodates the needs of different groups, and some groups will have different types of needs. So, the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child will have, what do you need to take into account to ensure that that housing provision is accessible to children and all of their needs, like schools being close by. But equally, you could, the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities will also require specific measurements to be taken to ensure access to housing provision which accommodates the needs of different disabilities, and that should be factored into the planning process. So in that convention and the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, you have the right to adequate standard of living and housing recognised and Article 28, but you also have the right to live in the community. So not just housing provision that's sort of separate to everyone else, or some for, sometimes the danger is what you'll see is the growth of institutionalisation. Actually, what Article 19 of the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities says is that you should have the right to live within your community. And so housing provision which meets this disabled need within the community itself. The next one around security of tenure, that is essentially about ensuring that your lease is strong. You have protection around being able to settle and enjoy your home over time. And so really it's the responsibility of the state and anybody that's exercising authority, whether that be a local a housing authority or a private landlord, to ensure that there's no threat of eviction. And if they're in the unusual circumstances that eviction does occur, it has to follow due process, be fair, give people the opportunity to have their voices heard as part of a really, robust legal process. But ultimately, if it's unavoidable, then there's a duty to find somewhere else for that person to live. So suitable accommodation, if, for example, eviction is it is something that can't be avoided. The next one around appropriate locations, I've kind of already spoken about that, about the availability of services being nearby, that people need to have access to healthcare facilities, to employment opportunities, to schools. And so location takes in that broader picture that it's not just housing stock without services. And then ultimately, that in order to make sure all these different things happen and continue to happen and to keep it under review, that there's a responsibility to ensure that there's a strategy in place, there's a housing plan, and there's the plan takes this into consideration and seeks to realise the right over time. So it's not just always emergency responses to crisis, but actually a plan over time which helps to protect and achieve the right.
That's really helpful, and a lot of that you just think actually all of those features you can see how all of those need to be in place and considered for people to be able to live a kind of a decent life with the basic essentials in place. Like if you're, if you don't have that security of tenure, then there's such an uncertainty that just can really impact your quality of life, and that's true of the other things as well. It's really helpful. So, all of these sound in some ways like this is the way things should be, but we know that we're far from that. So we know that actually there's really significant issues with a lot of these kind of issues and with housing in general, and we'll come on to some of that a wee bit more. But the UN also requires that states or countries progressively realise these rights. So there's a sort of recognition it's not overnight. But actually, there's sort of concrete steps using maximum available resources. Now we've had a webinar on this already, which goes into lots more detail around what that progressive realisation of rights must look like. But I just wonder if you want to say a few words about how that relates to this right to adequate housing.
Yeah, absolutely. So in a previous webinar, as you mentioned, we kind of broke down the different duties. So we have those general comments and we have places where we can go and find to understand what the right means in practice a little bit more. So all those different types of things to take into account. But separate to that, the treaty itself also requires lots of different steps to be taken to make sure the rights are implemented in practice. Recognising, of course, when I say all of this, the UK hasn't taken the steps to do that, so it's not occurring at the moment. It's just by chance, if you do end up in a situation where your right to adequate housing has been met, but what research tells us is that it's not across the board. It's a huge gap, and people live in circumstances that do not accommodate their right to adequate housing, and they have no remedies to solve it. That's the big problem that we're trying to fix in Scotland by taking steps to do that. But ultimately, you know, these steps that I'm about to explain, they're theoretical, but the UK is not actually made the move to make their legal obligations a requirement at the domestic level. So states they're supposed to take steps to fix this problem. They're supposed to, you know, regulate the market, protect people in terms of ensuring they're living in adequate housing, and over time progressively improve that process. So recognising that they can't fix everything immediately, but there should be a plan in place, and that plan has to properly understand where the most housing need is, which means properly understanding where the biggest gaps are. And you can't do that unless you generate enough data to understand, okay, we need to prioritise this group over here because their circumstances are absolutely dire and needs to be prioritised as quickly as possible to bring it up to what would be called minimum core. So progressive realisation is about over time, and minimum standards is about immediately enforceable. It is unacceptable for people to live in circumstances which impinge their dignity on a daily basis. So recognising those different, it's almost like if you think about it on a sliding scale of, yes, that's fantastic what we're achieving over time, but immediately we need to fix these issues. And ultimately, in addition to these minimum and progressive standards, what the treaty also requires states to do is to make sure there's no backsliding. So one of the big things that we've had historically is you might have had policies and measures that come in, you know, sort of waves over decades. And some of them have been really progressive and really good, and they've helped build up the stock. But ultimately, over time, the scale has just been going further and further and further down. And we know this because, like, impact of austerity affects people throughout their life course, reduces life expectancy, is really problematic. We know that, you know, policies which remove rights from people impact their right to life, and retrogression or backsliding on rights is also prohibited under this treaty, except from really exceptional circumstances. So if you were to embed these requirements into law, what you would see is that decision makers have to justify that they are taking all of these steps. And ultimately, if they are not, what it should do is open up routes to justice. So enable people to be able to go to a complaints mechanism, you know, ultimately a court as last resort. People much prefer to be able to access remedies and fix the problem much closer to, you know, their home through via decision maker or appeal mechanism. But ultimately there should be a remedy, there should be a way to access justice and fix the problem if all these things go wrong. And that's the last kind of component of what's required.
Thanks. And I think actually in terms of that access to remedy, so access to do something about it, do you know, when that right is not recognised, Let's look at that just now in terms of the Scottish Human Rights Bill, because at the moment we're saying there you should have this access to remedy, but right now there is an accountability gap. So as you explained before, because these are international level, but we need the international brought home into law here in order for there to be that access to remedy and actually sort of for people to be able to use that right. So at the moment, people on this call might be aware that there are the Scottish Government has committed to introducing a Scottish Human Rights Bill that will directly incorporate ISESCR, so the Treaty of Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, that includes this right to adequate housing in the same way that they've already done with the UNCRC. So people might be more familiar with that. And that will mean that those rights need to be taken into account in decision making. But also that means that the rights will be ultimately enforceable. That is, that people can ultimately enforce them in court if need be. You know, there's a lot of details of that, but can you just give us some reflections on why that incorporation is just so important for making this right a reality for people?
Yeah, I mean, all of the research that I've been doing for the past 20 years has been about when I first worked in a law firm and kind of work experience and seeing circumstances where people were living with, you know, there might be like black mold in the walls and the kids were getting sick. And we have examples of this now, you know, people, and I understand that people on the call and those living in circumstances which are so, so intrinsically difficult will know much better than I do about that. And we had, of course, the death of Awa Ishak from mould and ventilation problems in the house that caused respiratory illness. So my whole driving factor of all the research that I've done is that it's not good enough to simply say, you know, we're going to try and use these rights and embed them in our policies. I ultimately want to see backstops, which mean that when violations occur, you can hold a decision maker to account. Because ultimately, whilst it might work in practice in some places in forms of implementation, and you might see some good practice from local authorities or decision makers or the private landlords, I want to see a situation in which for those circumstances when it's not working and there isn't good faith and there isn't cooperation, people can hold that decision maker to account, ultimately in a court of law if required, if not in another place which is more suitable for the needs of that person whose rights been violated. And if you embed rights and incorporate them, ultimately, you should do it in a way which enables what access to effective remedies, which is what I'm speaking about. So the hope is, and the expectancy is, that the Scottish Government has a policy to incorporate, and that the Scottish Parliament seeks to do so in such a way, as far as possible, to embed remedies as part of an incorporating framework in areas of devolved competence. And that, and what makes it a little bit more difficult to do that is sometimes in the context of devolution, you don't have full levers of power over every area. So it would be great if the UK Parliament were to do it for everyone. But in the absence of that, the Scottish Government and Scottish Parliament can do so in devolved areas. There are some complexities around further steps that would be needed to make sure that the legislation in Scotland expands far enough to include all devolved areas. But if you were to overcome some of those complexities, yes, actually what you're doing is saying, this is a right in law, please comply with it. If you do not, we will seek a remedy in court. And remedies can be all sorts of different. So some remedies will go right to the heart of the problem and seek to fix it there. And others will say, this can't be solved overnight, but here's a plan to fix it as quickly as possible.
Thanks, that's really helpful. And actually, just to build on that idea of remedy. So as you were saying, there is a complexity here around devolution. What can the Scottish Parliament do? And what can it? But if those devolution type issues in terms of scope are sorted out by some means, and this Scottish Human Rights Bill is introduced and passed and has as broad and strong as possible right to adequate housing. So there's lots of ifs in there, but if that was to happen, it's very often that issues for individuals around housing are actually linked to systemic kind of structural issues. Things like there's not enough social housing, or there's not enough budget being put to things, or there's the different types of housing not being right. There's like really kind of systemic issues that then individuals face. If this new human rights law comes in as strongly as possible, what are your reflections in terms of how that would start to impact the improvement of the kind of housing system in Scotland, and in what ways might it help to do that? And sorry, that was a long question.
So what international human rights law tells us, and I think it's really important to recognise that any form of incorporation will encounter complexities and difficulties along the way, and these things may take time, because it's really important to manage expectations on that as well. But what I would say is that the international human rights framework provides an excellent vehicle to try and address a lot of these problems. It's not perfect either, but it sets out standards which, if embedded into domestic law, can enable transformative change. And you see that in other countries. And a really, really important part of that is around responding to what I would call the justice gap. So often what you'll see when accessing an remedy in law is that it's very complicated, it's very difficult to get advice, it's very difficult to have awareness of your rights. You may face, you know, barriers in accessing remedies. But if you were to embed it domestically as an incorporating right with access to effective remedies, that the justice system would need to change to try and better accommodate the fact that, yes, often when you see housing issues, they don't just apply to one person, they're systemic in nature. And so you need to have collective responses. So some of the research I've done on access to justice, people tell us that when they encounter a problem, they want an apology and an acknowledgement. They want it to stop happening, for the problem to be fixed, and they don't want it to happen to anyone else. And that last part's really important, because if you don't do structural and systemic change which applies collectively to everyone, then you're requiring on everyone complaining separately and individually, which creates this system where the burden's placed on the individual. You've got fear of retribution, you've got to access the advice, representation, have resilience to challenge the system, and then nothing changes for anyone else, which is incredibly frustrating. So embedding economic and social rights properly requires legal systems to change to address that need. So systemic cases and structural responses are a way of doing that. Where, for example, the UN, I'll give an example of a case in the UN committee, recently heard a case from Spain in which someone had been forcefully evicted without due process. So they hadn't had the chance to get a lawyer to defend their case, and there was a breach of their human rights. But what the committee said was, this shouldn't have happened to you, but it shouldn't have happened to anyone. So what Spain needs to do is go and change its law so that it fixes this systematically, so that evictions don't happen in this way. And where they are unavoidable, there needs to be steps taken way in advance to ensure whoever has been evicted is rehoused in suitable accommodation in a way which meets their needs. But that should only be in the most exceptional of circumstances. So it's an example to say that when that one person, you know, raised a red flag to say there's a problem here, the response was, well, actually, this is statewide, fix it for everyone. And those types of remedies are incredibly powerful to help resolve that collective issue. Other places like Colombia have a system where it becomes clear there's lots of people raising the same issue over and over again. Courts will group those cases together and say, we're going to deal with this systematically for everyone. And so the orders apply more broadly to even those that weren't in the case. So it's about those types of responses. Now, we're not there yet, but the pressure that this framework creates is to come up with mechanisms to do that better.
Thanks. So yeah, that is really helpful. We're not there yet. You know, they've not got that accountability and that access to justice as yet, and rights embedded into decision making. But that's where we should be, and that's where we're headed. Is really helpful. And I think I hope that's a helpful in response to a couple of the questions actually in the chat box. They go into, well, you know, what can we do about these rights and to make them real, and just say we can't today in the time get into what's in different pieces of Scots law already that relate to this, of which there aren't many. So things like, I totally get that Housing Scotland Bill is really relevant, but we wouldn't have time to get into the different components of that today, I'm afraid. Although, yeah, as I say, really important. But I wonder if I can come to the question about, in light of the UNCRC incorporation, so that's a Children's Rights Convention that's been put in Scots law. Isn't temporary accommodation a breach of children's rights to adequate housing? And what does their access to justice look like come 16th of July, which is the date when that piece of law will actually come into force? Do you have any reflections around that sort of temporary accommodation and how that relates to children's rights, which are now part of our law very directly?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, in order to answer that, it would require really getting into the nitty gritty of the devolved complexities. So I think a helpful way to respond to it is that both the Incorporation Act for UNCRC and the Human Rights Bill, which incorporates wider treaties, need to be looked at as stepping stones towards better protection of rights. And yes, the UNCRC Incorporation Act opens a door for fixing, for example, temporary accommodation can be justified in some circumstances, but not if it's unreasonably used. And it is unreasonably used when there is no end to it and there is no plan to fix it. Also, it needs to accommodate specific needs, and the International Human Rights Framework tells us all of this. All those rules apply. And importantly, I've mentioned those very dire circumstances that have led to the death of children in temporary accommodation. So complete breach of human rights, absolutely, clearly so. The way that housing, temporary housing is the provision that it's provided under in Scotland is under the Housing Scotland Act from 1987. Now, because of the way the Supreme Court has recently interpreted some devolved legislation, that means that in order for it to apply under the UNCRC Act, the Scottish Parliament needs to take some further steps. So the UNCRC Act opens the door, but to make sure that that Act bites in relation to temporary accommodation, there would be an extra step for the Parliament to say, OK, we're taking this housing area, devolved area, and we're putting it in an Act of Scottish Parliament in a slightly different way. So I'm aware that to delve deeper and deeper into that might just open up too many complexities, but it's an excellent question. And yes, it will make a difference, provided that extra step is taken. Access to justice should be enabled. And ultimately what it means is that there would need to be a justification for temporary accommodation, and that the assessment of that, the intensity of review around that, would be whether or not it's reasonable. And often what you'll see is policies and implementation is not reasonable, which would require immediate steps to be taken to fix it.
Yeah, thanks. That is really, really helpful. There's a question here about, given that some councils in Scotland are not currently meeting their statutory duties in relation to homelessness services, and no action appears to be being taken in terms of accountability, how confident can we be that incorporation will ensure rights are actually realised?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really important point. The right to housing in Scotland is actually already a statutory right. Under the Homelessness Scotland Act 2003. So when someone presents as homeless, they have a right to a house, and that's an immediate right. It already exists in law. So the difference that properly embedding this framework would mean is that the remedy component would be fixed. So at the moment, the remedy is for someone who's homeless to raise a judicial review, which is a very cumbersome legal process. And my understanding in practice is what will ha sometimes happen is if that person manages to get access to sufficient advice, a letter to the council might prompt a response if judicial review is threatened. That's not good enough. That's not access to an adequate and effective remedy. So actually the system needs to change to ensure access to justice is more easily realizable. So what you see in systems which do embed those routes to remedy is that, for example, even in England at the moment, the Housing Ombudsman has been more proactive in investigating mould and damp, particularly in relation to these temporary accommodation cases, and systematically saying this is a problem. Often what local authorities or landlords will say is, oh, this is an individual's use of the house, and they'll place the blame back onto the individual. But what that ombudsman has done is opened up the door and said, no, this is actually systematic, and it's applying across the board, and it's the fault of the landlord, and we need the landlords to respond and fix this. And so what they do at the very least is make that injustice visible and make it collective and make the claims realizable across the board, even though it might still take some time to fix. It's a step. And so you need a similar response to homelessness, a recognition that this has been ignored, systematically ignored across the board, and that's not good enough. And actually there was a question in there about the housing regulator. I think there was a investigation into practice around this. The regulator, alongside courts, ombudsman, and local complaints mechanisms, should all be seeking to fulfil rights all of the time. So at the moment, the regulator's not under a duty to apply this lens. It's not under a duty to say, well, what is the right to adequate housing and is it being met? So incorporating and the Human Rights Bill and the UNCRC Act should automatically make regulators take that into account as part of their day-to-day practice. And that's another important place where remedies might happen.
Thanks. Can I just go over by a couple of minutes maybe, but can I combine two of the questions which are around affordability? So one about, in order for old council housing to be raised to an adequate standard, rents would then have to be raised to an unaffordable level. So in this case, would the Scottish Government be duty bearer and need to fund the necessary upgrades instead of tenants? And kind of similar in a way is considering the majority of council budgets have already been set. Has the Scottish Government stated any way of fixing current council stock of housing or building social housing without ousting current tenants or potential new tenants due to the rent? You know, almost like where would the money have to come from? And is it fine for the money just come by putting rents up, as opposed to either national or local budgets? Or do you have any reflections without, I know you can't speak to the exact detail of Scottish Government plans, but any reflections on how that relates to that right to adequate housing?
The right to adequate housing requires states, which may be through like actual budget at the national level, to gather and deploy the maximum available resources of a state. So that means setting progressive tax measures across the state to fulfill its rights in all different areas, because they're all interrelated and it can be quite a complex framework. And there are like so that so in one sense, like the budgetary decision making is absolutely fundamental to rights fulfillment, but it needs to be looked at as a whole. And you can understand where at local levels, if there's not enough money and no other means of raising it, you're going to end up in a situation where you don't have enough money to fulfill rights. So a human rights framework or a lens applied to that would investigate and interrogate what's gone wrong where. Where else could this money be come from? And ultimately ask the state to justify its approach all the way up to state budget level, all the way down to local authority level. You can't delegate functions and then not delegate the money to fulfill them. In the same way, you can't delegate rights compliance and then not enough money to provide for them. So rather than me give an example of how that problem will be fixed, what I would say is that in reflecting on the international human rights framework, what it would tell us is that states need to gather enough resources. That doesn't necessarily mean through just one mechanism. They need to think about all the different ways that that could happen, and then they need to prioritise those most in need to fulfil the rights. And ultimately, and this is probably part of where the biggest gap is, and you see this again in other countries, one of the biggest cases on the right to adequate housing was in South Africa, and the problem was there was no plan. There was no plan at state level. There was no policy that was that the state could provide and say, here's our approach over time. Like, we can't do this tomorrow, but we can do this over the next few months, and we can do this over the next few years. And immediately what we'll try and do tomorrow is this. So you had some steps in place. And that's where the biggest gap is, because actually what those that are trying to work out whether or not there's rights compliance or not is they need to see that plan and then have an opportunity to assess it and then have an opportunity to challenge it, and then the decision maker or estate has an opportunity to respond and justify. And if that justification is not reasonable according to the test of reasonableness in international law, then it's a breach of the right. So the most important part of that is to actually have a feasible and reasonable plan in place, which is often what's missing, because at the moment there's no requirement to have that.
Thanks. I am very aware that we could actually go on and discuss the detail all afternoon, if not all week, actually. And actually, maybe it would be helpful for the consortium to have a bigger event, potentially hybrid, around the right to housing. So for those on the call, if that's something that you would find really useful, then do drop us a line and let us know, because there's a lot of detail. I think what is helpful just to remember that one of the principles of economic social rights, including right to housing, is no one left behind. That it's you've got to have a plan to improve things, not just for some, but for all of us, and particularly for those who are often ignored. So on that huge thanks to Katie for taking these questions. Well, so thank you everybody for joining us, and thanks again to Katie, and hope everyone has a good day.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the Human Rights 2020s podcast. For more information about our work as Scotland's civil society network for the protection and promotion of human rights, please visit our website at www.hrcscotland.org or follow us on Twitter at @hrcscotland. Thank you.